Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 10, delivered on February 19, 2018. The title of this lecture is Yields.
Today, yields. Now, the term yield is, as I said in the last lecture, just one of a small cluster of terms that mean kind of the same thing. We use different words in different contexts. Yield, discount rate, interest rate, and all that. Before I get started here, I want to show you a couple of things. Keeping you so that you are seeing screens as part of your common knowledge. Well, no, let me do this first. Okay. So you can show me that you are beginning to kind of catch on to this. Madam, up day, down day, flat day. Pretty much almost a flat day, you see. I mean, those are statistically insignificant. S&P 500, a 4%, 0.04% rise. Dow, 0.8. The NASDAQ was a little bit more significant. The small cap stocks took a little bit more of a hit today. Let me look at this S&P 500, zero in on it. Now it's your turn to do on-the-fly analytics for me. Someone I haven't bothered too much of late. Ouch. Okay. Okay. Ma'am, talk to me about the day. Okay, let's start. Who was in charge at the bell, bulls or bears? Come on, don't be afraid, just tell me. No, we're not looking at a number. Bulls or bears in charge today? Anyone want to help? Okay, come on.
At the very beginning, it was the bulls. Like the, right away.
The bulls came out of the gate just. Madam?
Yes.
Concentrate.
Okay.
Okay. What happened at about maybe 9 o'clock to the bulls?
The Bears came.
You're gonna say it out loud.
The Bears came.
The Bears came in and they slapped those bulls around. Okay, and the Bears had a little bit of a smackdown. About a little after 10 o'clock, what happened, sir? Go. Talk to me.
The Bulls came back.
The Bulls came back hard for a while.
So hard.
Yeah, till about just after midday. They were doing good. What happened about a little after midday? The Bears came back. So it was out of the gate, and then the Bears, and then the Bears took the picnic basket. Toward the end of the, toward after about 2 p.m., what happened? Talk to me.
The Bears. Are the Bulls in?
Say it out loud. Don't be afraid. The Bulls what?
Started going down.
Bulls started going down. The Bulls made a pull, a rally. Do you see that after 2 p.m.? The Bulls rally came in. The Bears came back, and the Bulls weren't going to have any of it. Slap, 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 and it was moo, snort, growl. And then at the end of the day, what did you see there, sir, that we've seen before at the end of the day?
At the very end?
Yeah.
looks like the bears.
Yeah, there was a sell-off again at the end. You remember that notch I've been talking about? We see it. It's starting to get to be a little tedious, that notch is. You remember? You've seen that in previous days. At the end of the day, the bulls just grab, are grabbing at what they can, but then the bears just come back and they slap it hard at the end. In that sell-off there at the end. And again, remember, we've seen that before. You see that notch there at the end, down? We just keep seeing that. And it's a characteristic of a market where, at the end of the day, have you ever seen a bull actually, you know, charging, coming snort, snort? Well, here's the thing. If you are ever in a ring with a bull, okay, you just keep running around and running around and running around. And eventually, by the end of the day, the bull, he's tired if he's not a healthy bull. And that's what we see here. By the end of the day, the bulls have fought through the day to keep, and they keep rallying. But at the end of the day, they just don't have it in them to keep it going at the end and hold the price, gains. So you had, at the beginning, the bulls were feeling good. They had some, you know, bull oatmeal for breakfast. But at the end, they just weren't able. Now, notice something else that's harder to see here. Let's see if I can expand this, roll this up a little bit. This down here is the volume by, I think these are 15-minute period volume. What do you see there at the very end, madam?
It's just going back down.
No, it's not. There's a spike in volume at the end. I'm talking about those little bars down there at the bottom. Those represent volume. You see how the volume was fairly steady through the day? It got a little stronger in the 2 p.m. period. But then, do you see how there was a lot more activity toward the end of the day? And then at the very end, see when that notch happens? That's when the volume spiked. Indicating, well, I want you to think about, what does that mean? We're seeing the bears took over at the end. There was a volume spike. In other words, that volume was sell volume. Okay? It's clear from this that spike of volume there at the end. The battle had been going on, but at the end, look at that one last 15 minutes. Whack! The bears just came in and sold the hell out of the market, the S&P 500. This is analytics. This is the real deal. Now, analytics is mathematical. There's numbers, but analytics has to go beyond numbers. And in this case, and again, this is why finance isn't accounting. We don't stop at the numbers. We say, what do these numbers mean to us? I could tell you these volume numbers. I could even read these off to you and say, all right, look at this. See the numbers, 22, 19. And then there at the end, look at that last spike. 32, almost 33 million down. But what does that mean? That means that the bears had enough of this rally nonsense, and they cleared out the market. They cleaned it up. They sold out. And then, so it was sort of like two things here. One is that the previous close and the open, there's really not a whole lot of difference there. But that volume does not describe what happened. That's the volume of the whole day. And we see that the whole day is not representative of what happened at the margin of the day, which is what we care about. What happens at the last? And so the volume doesn't tell us as much as what happened at the end versus what was going on through the day. A mother's work is never done. So anyway, that is that. Now, let me take you to something else here. And I swear one of these days I'll remember it. I'm going to go back to that dynamic yield curve. By the way, the dynamic yield curve, the link to it is on my podcasting site in the left scroll bar. Okay, the dynamic yield curve, just to see where the where the economy is and whither the economy, the market will go. And in this case, dynamic yield curve, and again, this link is on my podcasting site in the left scrolling marquee. Again, there you go. That yield curve is flattening. Do you see how it's flattening there in the 7 to 10? Well, it's going to be a little scarier when I show you the next thing. But remember, what do we call it when a yield curve has a shorter rate that is higher than a longer rate? What kind of a yield curve is that? Do you remember?
Inverted
yield curve. And what does an inverted yield curve indicate?
Recession, maybe?
A possibility, a very good possibility. Now, every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. However, looking forward, not every inverted yield curve has led to a full recession. Sometimes it leads to just a pause. But let's have a look at what's going on. Now, here we look at the numbers, but we don't have to do hard math. This isn't tough math. Now, I'm going to come back here. Okay, what I want to do here is I'm going to focus on the 7 to 10. Okay, now we're going to go back maybe about a week. Okay, let's look at the 7 to 10. Now remember, a yield curve should rise because of an increasing maturity premium. It is a very sick economy when that doesn't happen. Well, let's look back here. There's the 7, there's the 10. Okay. Here on the 9th, the spread was 9 basis points between the 7 and, I'm sorry, 11 basis points between the 7-year and the 10 on the yield. Go down 9 basis points next trading day. Down to the 13th, 9 basis points. Still the 10 years above the 7-year. And then we get to the 14th. It is now standing at 7 basis points. Do you see how the longer yield is sagging down on it? I want to make sure that you see that. It's still above it. Let's go down to yesterday, or to the 15th. Yesterday. 7 basis points. And then today, 8 basis points on the day. It's wavering. It is not, and this is what I saw in the last bad recession. It just floats there. The 10 stayed above the 7 just barely, and it floated there, and it can do that for weeks. Hell, it was doing it for several months in the crash of 2008. But you're see how it's, go clear back here to the beginning of the year. You had a spread of 13 basis points. Oh, hell here. Yeah, it was pretty robust. Here you had 14. You're seeing a slow sagging happening. It is trying to invert. It's not there yet. It probably won't get there for a while. It's going to just float. The 10-year will stay above the 7-year, and then sometime, and it's hard to predict when, all of a sudden, just for a while, you'll see that rate above that rate. I'm sorry, that rate, the 10-year, below that rate, the 7-year. There will be a technical inversion, and all it has to do is do it once, and even for just a few hours, and then you've got your call for the recession. But right now, it's just hanging there. And there won't be a recession. A recession, if it's going to happen, it won't happen until after the yield curve inverts. And so far it's not inverting, so we can't call a recession yet. Although we probably would like to. Politically, emotionally, intellectually, we'd like to call it, but you can't call it until you get the technical signal. So there you go. That's where we stand right now. It's trying to invert. Go. The whole idea there, that's a good, excellent question. Do you panic and run now, or do you wait for things to get worse? You can't just trade and trade and trade. At this point, if you have the ability, you start to prepare your portfolio. You get yourself like, remember I showed you, and I'm going to do this actually right now again. Write this up here, just so you can see it. You have your equity position, your debt position, and your cash position. Now, if it's a good market, probably, and I'm just going to put a couple of numbers up here. You do 60, 35, oh, actually, in this kind of a market, it'd be almost more like 70 and 30. And your cash position, maybe. This was such a good market. I'm going to say 75% equity, 20% debt, and then 5% in cash, in a cash fund, treasuries. Now, where we are now, you probably, it's time to at least know where you're going to go. In other words, this isn't just equity. You've got your stuff, you've got your money in things, mutual funds, ETFs, whatever. And you've got your money in debt things as well, mutual funds, ETFs, whatever. And you've got your money in cash. So even if you are not going to run right now, you should know where you're going to run. Okay, I'm going to sell out of this and go into this. Well, what is this you're going into? Find your targets, look at their performance in bad times, and say, okay, when I finally decide it's time to do my rebalancing, I know I'm going to sell this, and I'm going to tell the broker buy, and you're going to give them a trading symbol. Okay? Now, what trading symbol are you going to use? Here comes the next thing. I'm going to take you back here to this part. The classic ETF, electronically traded fund, would be the SPDR. It's a massively well-balanced portfolio of the Standard 500, Standard & Poor's 500. As you can see, it tracked the market today, because it is basically almost the whole market. It's 70% of the market. And as you can see, the Standard & Poor's 500, the ETF, the SPDR, did what the Standard & Poor's did. I showed it to you. And its beta is exactly one. It is the market. And it's got a very attractive expense ratio. In other words, they don't spend a lot on themselves. And I would have probably said, if you've got no more creativity and you want the market, well, just put it into Standard & Poor's 500, the ETF, the SPY, S-P-Y, we call it the SPDR. Okay, that would have been your equity. Now, what about debt? Well, if you're into ETFs, you can't go wrong with this. This aggregate bond fund is so large and respectable, it is used as the benchmark for all other bond funds. It is the benchmark, the AGG, not all others. Notice something interesting about the bond fund right now. Do you see flight to quality? In other words, as investors were pulling out of stocks, notice how the bonds were holding their own, because those investors that were pulling out of stocks were going to bonds. And the classic bond ETF is AGG. And as we can see, it's got a beta of 1.2, 1 as well. It tracks the market. So if you put those two together, so then the question is, okay, what does that mean for that? Oh, well, I had 75% of my money, of the money I've got invested. I had it in the SPY, and I had 20% in AGG. Okay, now, I know what I'm going to do if I like these two funds. When I decide it's time to leave, I'm going to call my broker and I'm going to say, all right, I want you to sell this much of my SPY and use the proceeds to buy that much of AGG. Something like that. So in other words, you also want some for cash too. So when I decided it was time, if I think this is going to be a pretty bad one, I'd go, tell the broker, all right, I want to go from 75% of my money invested in the market in the ETF SPY. I want to bring that down to 40% of my money. And I want you to move that over to AGG. I want you to move 30%. I want you to move 30% of it over. And then the rest of it put into my cash fund. And if I get really scared of this market, I'd peel another probably 10% off the equity, put 5% of it into AGG and the other 5% into cash. That's just rough rule of thumb. You can do as you want, but you're near the point now where you don't lose your cool. And that's one important thing. Don't ever panic before it's time to. That's one of the ways that you die in combat is when someone freaks out and starts running, screaming, or starts shooting, and then you've blown your whole position, your control of your position. Anyway, that's that. Gives you an idea of how we use these things in real life and how we look at data. And these are just, I'm giving you just some examples here. I mean, I'm going to show you more mutual funds. These are ETFs. I'm going to show you mutual funds you can invest in that are equity. There's different things you can look at. Okay, how do I know if a fund is good, a mutual fund or an ETF? The first thing that you would probably want to do is look at its Morningstar rating. Morningstar rates from up to 4 stars. That's just basically a rule of thumb. You also want to look at the expense ratio. Look at how much does the management spend on itself. The spider, well, let's look at this expense ratio for this little thing, too. See how these are very low. I mean, I was just looking at a couple this morning that had 2% expense ratios. In other words, 2% of the money they spend on the salaries and nice things for the people who run the fund. And I thought, I'm not even going to buy into that. I'm not paying for their 3-martini lunch. And so that's one good thing that you want to look at is the expense ratio. And there's some other things, too. Also, look at the yield. Notice that the yields are not spectacular, but then again, if you're trying to run away from a market that is in a hurricane down, 2.35% is going to look kind of attractive, especially for something that's relatively safe compared to equity. Okay, now, what do I mean by yield? Now, you've already seen, I showed you yields in the last lecture. I'm going to refresh your memory a little bit on what yields are and all of that. And we always state things unless otherwise told. If I give you a yield, it's an annualized yield. And if it is not annualized, the first thing I'm going to do is annualize it. So, let me see something here. Let me look at some 5-year data. Interesting. By the way, do you see how bonds, this is a bond fund, AGG is a bond fund. Do you see how in a good market, bond funds don't do very well? Because everyone's in stocks. Bonds are safe havens. So if you don't need a safe haven, then you'd probably not be wanting to do a lot of bonds. That's why in a good market, you have only a small percentage of your holdings in bonds. But notice that AGG started to have a few, there were worries back in 2017, in the early part of 2017. There was concern back then. Even though the stock market was still going up, there was some concern about the political stability of the country. And there was a good run for bonds. But then they started losing their luster again because everything looked okay. Yeah, the world didn't come to an end. But now, right now, look at that. Not the notch down, the notch up. So there you go. Okay, let's do something here. I'm going to look. Suppose that on September the 2nd, 2013, I bought AGG. Okay? I went in 100 round lot of AGG. Which would have, you don't have to do it that way. It was 106.80. Now let's look at its price at the end of today. It settled at 106.85. Let me find something else, okay? That's going to be such a tiny yield, it's ridiculous. I apologize. Let me go back to this spider. At least I'll have something that'll show. Let me do the 5-year, okay. Suppose that let me get 2000 September. Maybe I can find September. September, that's September 20th, is that what that says? What's that huge gap in there for? Huh, 23rd. Oh, that's 2013. Yeah? Okay, September 23rd. Let's do September 23rd, 2013. The price would have been, for my shares of that, would have been actually, I bumped that. 168.91. Suppose you sold out today on the spider. You closed your position on February, what's today, the 19th, 2018. You closed your position out today, and it would have come out, your close was 273.16. First thing we want to do is we're going to annualize the yield. And that would be the ending value, 273.16, over the beginning value, 168.91. Now we have got to raise that to 1 over the number of years. Okay. We're going to go back to that nice little calculator. That one that days between two dates. Yeah, if you got an app for that on your, or if you got a phone or pull it out, if you want to see this, do it yourself. Okay, so we want, what was it, September 23rd, 2013, and ending on February the 19th of 2018. Huh? Oh, I did. Okay, there we go. Really? Wait. I can do this myself, okay? You're not my mother. Not my real father either. Darth is my real father. Okay, there. Happy? Calculate the duration. 1,610 days, okay? So, what I would probably want to do then, if I wanted the years, I'd just take a calculator. 1,610 days, divide that by 365. Someone was crabby. Who was it in here? Someone was griping that I didn't do 365.25 days. Yeah, it must be an accounting major or something. Okay. Okay. Now I'm going to put that in my memory. That's what I'm going to do, is I'm going to actually save that memory save to the memory. So then all I have to do is take the open parenthesis, 273.16, divided by 168.91, close the parentheses, and then raise that, I said raise that, where are they? Oh, there it is, to the open parenthesis, 1 divided by the memory recall, close the parenthesis. Oh, and then I need to subtract 1. Don't forget that. There. Minus 1. So over that almost 4.5 year period, 11.52% return. Is that right? Yeah, 5.2%. That was the return, the annualized return on the portfolio, on this ETF. If you had held over that period, that ETF, that's what your return would have been. That's also, interestingly enough, not a bad estimate of what the return to the market itself was, because the S&P 500 is so much of the market. I mean, it's an estimate. The market over that period of about 4.5 years returned about 11.52%, 11.5%. That was for a beta of 1.00. The return to the portfolio that would be the market itself. And so you could say, well, betas above 1 probably would have performed better. They should have in a well-diversified portfolio. And betas below 1 would probably have performed a little lower than that. Not worse, it's just you choose your beta and you get your expected return. So if I were to look at a beta of, let's say, 1.5, in a well-diversified portfolio, that stock would have probably done about 50% better than 11.5%. If I had chosen a beta of about 0.75, you're a defensive investor, you probably would have gotten about 25% lower than 11.5%. That doesn't mean that beta, that lower value is bad. You chose a risk position. And that's what you get for it. There's no good or bad about it. But I will show you later, interestingly enough, there's something called Jensen's Alpha. And we look at stocks, mutual funds, portfolios, ETFs, and we say, what should they have done versus what did they do according to these numbers here? Okay, I know that a beta of 1.5 should earn about 50% more than that. So I would say times 1.5. Okay, I've got a stock that has a beta of 1.5, and in a portfolio, it performed at 18%. We would say in that case that that stock had a Jensen's Alpha of, about 70 basis points. 0.7%. In other words, it outperformed the market what it should have a little bit. Suppose that we had a stock get back to that market. Suppose we had a stock that had a beta of 0.75. Well, that's what, in a well-diversified portfolio, that's what it should have done. It was about 8.6%. Well, suppose that it came in and its actual performance was 8%. Then in a case like that, I'd say that its Jensen's alpha was negative 60 basis points. Jensen's alpha is a way to look at mutual funds, ETFs, and other stocks in well-diversified portfolios and say, are they doing what they should? Are they doing a little better, a little worse? They shouldn't. Very often, you're not going to see positive Jensen's alphas very often, but you are going to see negative Jensen's alphas rather frequently. In a good portfolio, you're just monitoring it, and when you see a Jensen's alpha that stays negative for more than, say, 6 months a year, you kick it out and bring something in that's got a positive Jensen's alpha. That's one way you can manage your portfolio. Just keep skimming off the cream and throwing away the crud at the bottom. Let me show you a practical problem. Kind of presents an interesting ethical issue. Trying to look at find someone in here who looks like a good candidate for the example in this problem. You, sir. You've fallen on hard times. I mean, nothing is going right. You lost your dog. He left you. You lost your apartment, or you're about to. And you're really hard up for some money. You don't have a job anymore because basically they didn't want you anymore. They replaced you with a robot. So you're kind of, but you know you're probably going to be able to come back, but you got to pay rent. You got to pay your cell phone bill. So what you do is you go to one of those payday loan places. You just got a job, but you're not going to have your pay for a couple of weeks, so what you do is you get yourself a $500 personal loan. Now what they're going to do is they're going to say, all right, well, we give you, it's a little harsh, our interest rate, but you know, there's a lot of risk involved. So we're going to charge you 19.99%. Okay? Per year. But you need this loan for only 2 weeks. So that means that you would pay 19.99% divided by 2 weeks of a year, which would be divided by 26, 2 weeks of 52. Well, this doesn't seem that bad. I mean, you work this out and you say, well, that's $500 times 0.199 divided by 26. So your interest is only $3.84. I mean, that's not bad. Okay, you put those two numbers together and you say, all right, well, I'm about to write them the check for that they will cash in 2 weeks for $503.84. Oh, wait, you can't. No, you write it for, because we got your processing fee and we got your credit check fee. The processing fee is $10 and the check fee is $25. So you just write that check for $538.84. Okay. No big thing. Now let's find out what your actual interest rate is annualized. Now understand, this problem, this issue came to the Supreme Court some years back. Back before you were born, it was in the 1990s, I believe. And the Supreme Court's just, they are not math people. They're not finance people. They dismissed the lawsuit. They just found it completely ridiculous that there was someone who was questioning this whole crap. that was going on. But it's not crap. It's real. Let me show you. Okay. Ending value, $538.84 divided by the beginning value, $500. Raise that to the 1 over the number of years. Okay, so this is actually, the number of years here would be 2 weeks or 14 days divided by 365. Or you could just say 2 divided by 26, 2 divided by 52. So this is actually 0.03846 of a year. Memory save. So in other words, the exponent will be 1 over 0.0384. So let's run the numbers. 538.84 divided by 500. Raise that to the 1 divided by the number of years, which was 0.0384. Close the parentheses, and don't forget to minus your 1. Holy crap. That wasn't a percentage. That's the percentage. That's the actual rate on that loan. Now, used to be laws that were called anti-usury laws or usury laws that sent people back in the Middle Ages, they executed people for interest rates like this. In modern times, those laws are still on the book. And this is way past anything that is even in the universe of sanity. This was the subject of the lawsuit. These violate usury laws. These places are predators. They're insane predator. And the Supreme Court rebuffed it. That's not an interest rate. You're adding in things that are just fees. Go away. You know as well as I do, that's part of the interest rate. It is part of the effective yield of the loan. And when you put that in there, look at that thing. Spank me, Jesus. That's awful. Anyway, you see the problem? Because if you don't include all of the costs in your calculations of N minus begin, then you are missing, you are actually not calculating your true yield. This also applies to stocks and bonds. When you buy and sell them, the sell price, what you get at the end, at the beginning, you don't pay that close price, that price that you order. You're paying that plus your broker commission. At the end, when you sell, you are not going to keep net that money. You're going to keep that net of money that's in this extra money. You follow me on this? So you've got to keep in mind that we have to talk about net cost and net gain. Broker's commissions will kill you. And that's why you don't want to buy and sell too fast. That's the problem with ETFs. They're stocks. So you buy, you pay a commission. You sell, you pay a commission. Mutual funds are better because you don't pay a commission when you move the funds. The downside of mutual funds is, unfortunately, that you've got only 4 times a year when you can make your trades. So you own mutual funds, sir, and it's right after you have gone long into equity that the zombie apocalypse occurs. Okay, the next morning you look out there, at first you just think it's the neighbor kids, and then you realize they're green, and then I got to get you to move out of my mutual funds there. Go into bonds. Now, I'm sorry, sir. It's not your window. Okay? you're dead. Okay? That's the problem with the mutual funds. So there's a trade-off there. No matter how you play, you're going to have to... That's why that goes back to that pre-planning. Know when your windows are, if you're in mutual funds especially, and know exactly what to do when your window opens. Okay, now, next thing on this agenda here. So now you see some practical uses of those calculation of yields. Next thing. This was a little more complicated. Okay, let's say that the real remember the thing I showed you that an interest rate is the risk-free rate plus the default premium, R sub D plus R sub M plus R sub L, the default maturity and liquidity. Those two make the default premium. And inside of this little bad boy right here, the risk-free rate, there is the real rate of return plus the expected inflation premium. Anything you see that has not subtracted out the expected inflation premium is a nominal rate. And it is a tricky business subtracting out the expected inflation premium. A lot of times, they just subtract the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, or something like that. Not a good idea because that's a historical rate. There's a problem with this right here. We use it in practice all the time. But let me show you something. Suppose that the real rate of return is 3.8%. And the expected inflation premium is 1.4%. That would mean that the risk-free rate is 5.2%. But actually, it's not. This is a wrong way to calculate it, and we do it. You'll see me do it all the time. Here's what you should do. You should take 1 plus 0.038 times 1 plus 0.014 minus 1. You're looking at me. It's called the Fisher effect. Rates are not additive. They're compounding. They're multiplicative. So if I did 1.038 times 1.014 minus 1, 5.253. Notice that it's not a major difference. But as those numbers get bigger, those rates get bigger, the spread between the additive and the Fisher effect result gets larger. That can mean a lot if you are handling a portfolio of millions and millions of dollars and you're forecasting. For all intents and purposes, adding the two up doesn't hurt much. They're slightly wrong, your answers are. But they are not exactly right. You should multiply interest rates to get the result you want. Let me show you something here. Go back to that rate table here. And here, I'm going to teach you a little terminology, and then I'm going to take you on a little journey here. I want to go back and get those. Oops. Okay. Treasury yield. Okay, this is what I had shown you before, right here. I'm going to show you this, not do a lot of explaining, but I'm going to show you something. But first, I'm going to give you some terminology. When I did oil and gas exploration and exploitation in Texas, by the way, there are no two-syllable words down there. It's not Texas, it's Texas. It's not Dallas, it's Dallas. Excuse me. Not oil and gas, oil and gas. Okay? So we were out there, we did exploration for oil and gas, and what we would do is, if we punched and we were successful, and we're not talking a gusher spraying out, we're talking about small winds and a lot of dry holes, you would collect the oil from the pump jacks into these reserve tanks, and then every now and then a truck, a Cocaline truck, would come by, and they would buy and draw the oil out that you had pulled. And like I said, it's not, you know, 50 barrels out of it or 88 barrels, 100 barrels once in a while on a well. But the deal was this. Cocaline driver, you had a choice. You could buy, or rather, you could sell at spot or forward. Spot meant that you sold at whatever the spot rate on oil was at the time the Cocaline driver got to your tanks. Or you could make a deal for a guaranteed forward for, let's say, 6 months. So I could sell, I could do spot, or we could do spot with Cocaline, or we could say, all right, let's say that right today, let's say today spot is $42 per barrel for pretty darn sour crude. Okay. Now, the driver or the Cocaline, he would offer you forward 6 months at $37.50 per barrel. Now you understand that you can take either one, spot or forward. So if you are risk averse, madam, if you're risk averse, would you go spot or forward? Bingo. If you were a risk taker, you would go, obviously, with the spot price and hope to God that the price of oil doesn't go through the floor, which, of course, it did when we went spot. $34 a barrel at fine. It found its way down to within a week and a half after we rejected the forward at $37.50. Well, those weren't the numbers, but that anyway, okay, spot and forward. Now, so the terminology, spot and forward, means that a forward rate represents something in the future, as opposed to a spot rate, which represents something now. Okay? Some of you are going to get an interesting variation on that. I have a student. She said, they're offering me $54,000 plus a $2,500 signing bonus. But, I mean, I've got 6 months before I graduate. Should I take it? Do you see how she's actually facing the dilemma of spot versus forward? Does she take the forward and collect the money? Or does she take spot and hope that someone offers her more than that signing bonus plus the extra, plus the lower salary? You'll see, you'll run into it in your own lives on some occasions. Okay. Now, what this means in yields is this. You see in this chart here, and I'll blow this up a little bit. You see in that chart that, let's take a 2-year. 2.21%. Okay. Okay. That is a composite of a one-year spot and a one-year forward rate. This is just the composite of the average, in a way. So in other words, 1 plus this spot rate squared, I'm sorry, would equal minus 1. Would equal the 2.21%. Or I could say it this way. There is a one-year rate that's 2.00%. So 1.0200 times 1 plus the forward rate minus 1 equals the 0.0221. Watch what happens when I do that. So in other words, I'm saying there's the one-year rate, and then there's this hidden one-year rate for the from year one to year two. Watch what happens. And you don't have to understand the math quite yet. I want you to get exposed to the concept right off the bat. So I'm going to add the one to both sides, 1.0221. And then I'm going to divide that by 1.0200. Equals. Did I do that wrong? Yo. I did that wrong. 1.0221 minus 1 or plus 1. No, I didn't need to do that. Let me do that again. 1.0221 divided by 1.0200 equals 2%. Interesting. They're almost a flat yield curve, even down there. The forward and the spot are almost the same. So in other words, the 1 year and then 1 year out, take those together for the Fisher effect, that should create the 2 year. And in this case, those two curves are all, the two yields are almost the same, the 1 and the 2 year. So it's hidden. When you look at the numbers, you don't see that that is actually almost a flat forward rate on a yield curve. This yield curve is a lot flatter than it looks like at first blush. This is a yield curve that's actually kind of scary all the way through it. Now let me take this back one more time just to convince you of what's going on. Oops. Why is that pink? That was weird. Okay, real quick. Dynamic yield curve. There it is. Look at this one more time. I want to expand this so that you see what's going on. No, you fool, I don't want that. Okay, watch. Here it was. 6 months ago, Look at that thing flattening out. And now look at it here. Just in the last few days, it's arching, but it's flattening. It doesn't look like it in the chart, but the forward rate's telling me that it's flattening down here. So this is a curve that looks awfully unhealthy. To your question, sir, if you're asking what would I do, I just quietly reposition now, say FTS, which is a kind of ETF, and just wander away and dust off and just wait for the hurricane to end. If I were aggressive right now, I'd probably, instead of all of that going into bonds, I might buy something that's a little more metals-oriented, something like a gold mining stock, something like that, just for a side position in case this gets a lot worse than what people are predicting. Right now, mildly severe recession. That's what the thinking is. The naysayers are saying, no, this is going to be a Jim Dandy of a recession. It's going to be a bad one. Which is it going to be? Well, it depends. Whether you believe the conventional wisdom or believe your lying eyes. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.